Pop Health Podcast is a public service of 24-Hour Home Care.
And welcome to Pop Health Podcast. My name is Zach Morgan. I'm the host of Pop Health Podcast. I'm up here in beautiful San Francisco, California. I'm joined today by Ruth Saltzman. She's the BPCI Clinical Program Manager for a multiple hospital system, large and growing hospital system. Ruth, thank you so much for being with me today.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. So Ruth and I actually met a little while ago. I was hosting or moderating a panel at a healthcare leaders conference. The panel was specifically about, or the conference was about bundled payments and kind of the changing landscape of healthcare. And Ruth was one of the experts that was on the panel. So we were able to connect there. And I know we're trying to educate the audience on how healthcare is changing. And Ruth just happens to be one of the thought leaders with some of those changes moving forward. So I'm really excited to have her on today. Ruth, could you kind of give everybody an idea of your background in healthcare? How'd you get started? How'd you end up where you are now?
Absolutely. So I started out as an ER nurse, actually, for Kaiser, working in one of their biggest facilities in Santa Clara, California. And while I was doing that, I also went to UCSF graduate school and earned a master's in healthcare administration. It was perfect timing. My master's program started in 2010, which was right around when healthcare, when Obamacare, everything was changing. So it was the right time to be in school learning about what was coming up. And it was the perfect way to segue from the clinical side of healthcare to the administrative side of healthcare. So after being an ER nurse for 8 years, I transitioned into more the business side of healthcare.
Sure, and you got your start with Kaiser, and we actually were just talking before we started here that it seems like a lot of health systems are moving towards that Kaiser model. So maybe it was a good introduction for you at the way that healthcare is changing. For the people that might know you, it's probably mostly in a professional realm. Will you tell everybody maybe something that they might not know about you outside of work?
Absolutely. One thing that people are surprised to learn is that I was not born in the United States. I was born in the former Soviet Union, and I immigrated as a child. And so I have a very different perspective because I remember living in the Soviet Union and seeing how life was there and how life is in the United States.
Wow, I didn't know that either. Well, do you ever get to go back and visit?
I have visited. It's a very different world now.
Yeah, I know it's not quite back there, but my family is originally from Poland, and my mother and brother and myself got to go back and see Poland a couple of years ago. It was really eye-opening. What a great place. So, and it was also nice to see where all the food that I ate growing up came from. So first of all, before we dive into kind of how healthcare is changing, your title is BPCI Clinical Program Manager. What does that mean? First of all, like literally, what does it mean? And also, without getting into too many details right now, what is that?
Yeah. BPCI stands for Bundled Payment Care Initiative, which is a Medicare program that has started over the last couple of years as part of the Affordable Care Act, also known as Obamacare.
Absolutely. So with the changes that are happening and with the Affordable Care Act, that was a big one. People may or may not know that we're moving away from kind of the way that especially CMS used to operate with health systems. Can you give everybody kind of an idea for the listeners that may not know about the way that the healthcare system worked when it was under fee-for-service? What did that look like on a day-to-day basis? What did that look like in interactions with CMS? What was fee-for-service like?
Absolutely. So Medicare has existed for about 50 years, and really for those years, it was a fee-for-service free-for-all, meaning that patients who are 65 and over had Medicare, they went to the doctor, whatever number of doctors they went to specialists, they maybe were admitted to the hospital and then had potentially a skilled nursing facility stay, maybe had some home health or acute rehab. But there wasn't a lot of attention paid to what all those bills added up to and what the outcomes were. What were the quality outcomes? Did the patient actually benefit from all those services until more recently when we started paying attention that the Medicare spend per beneficiary was very high, but the outcomes weren't aligned with that, that we weren't having great outcomes. And frankly, the U.S. Medicare spend per beneficiary is significantly higher than other countries, yet their populations are healthier.
Right. Yeah, and I think that's an interesting statistic that has been out there about the spending per beneficiary and the actual outcomes not nearly matching up on the quality. When you're talking about seeing, you know, no matter what specialist they saw or what services they got, can you elaborate on that just a little bit as far as it was a literal fee for service for every single thing that, that a doctor prescribed or, you know, a hospital or a skilled nursing did for a patient? It was literally a fee for each of those things, correct?
Absolutely. Hospitals made money by heads and beds is a common term. They didn't look at what happens to patients when they once they leave the building. They really just said, okay, the patient has left. We're done with them until they get admitted again. The physicians, they saw the patient in the offices, but often didn't know that their patient was in the hospital. There was no real oversight. Nobody owned the entire care of the patient. There was very little communication. And again, everyone billed. If a patient didn't like what a physician said, maybe they went to another physician for the same exact diagnosis or the same thing, and everybody billed Medicare and Medicare paid, and nobody was adding up the dollars or paying attention to the multiple bills for the same things.
Right. And while in no way is it an indictment of the entire healthcare system, but in a lot of ways you could see how that would lead to maybe unnecessary visits or unnecessary procedures. And I know I read somewhere that there was the fallback of, well, better safe than sorry. But what I think they, when they started to look at it with the Affordable Care Act, maybe they were looking at either duplicate procedures or unnecessary specialists or unnecessary bed days.
Yeah, absolutely. And I agree. It's not an indictment of the previous healthcare system. It's not just about the money, but also when a person sees multiple physicians for the same thing, there is also the risk of multiple treatment for the same condition. As far as medications, we know that patients are over-medicated because they're seeing multiple doctors, and perhaps their primary care doctor wrote them a prescription for their heart failure, but so did the cardiologist, and now the patient is double-medicated. Not only is that harmful in the fact that patients shouldn't take more medications that are absolutely necessary, but it can lead to complications that lead to hospitalizations, sometimes unnecessary hospitalizations. And so it's important that the entire care of a patient is collaborated and everybody is aware of what's going on with this one person.
Right. And so you touched on kind of an important, maybe what was a first step in kind of the dominoes falling after the pass of the Affordable Care Act. One of the things in fee-for-service that was not necessarily focused on avoidance was readmissions. And so kind of I think the first thing that really hit kind of a wide population in the healthcare system was a focus on preventing readmissions. And they focused on 30 days. And I know you had a role with that first, but what was the aim with preventing 30-day readmissions?
Absolutely. I believe it was in 2009 or 2010 that a report came out that Medicare patients have a 20% chance of readmitting within 30 days of being discharged from the hospital. And if my grandparent went into the hospital and got discharged and the message is, there's a 1 in 5 chance that you're going to be back in 30 days, that's not a very positive thing to say right to a patient. And that's where we really were nationally. 20% of Medicare patients in the early 2010 area were at risk for coming back. And so out of that statistic, a lot of readmissions work began. That's about when I got into that realm was, and I would say that the Bay Area, the San Francisco Bay Area, has had a huge advantage in that context because around 2010, is when the Gordon and Betty Moore Foundation started in looking at readmissions and started investing in the Bay Area hospitals in creating transitions of care programs that would prevent readmissions. Sure. And that's how I got into this world of preventing readmissions that eventually led to this bundle payment initiative.
Right. And I think probably most people at this point have heard, at least, initially the readmissions focused on three main diagnoses. How did they come to those three initially? How did, you know, in kind of this first step in reform, how did they come to those initial three diagnoses?
Well, I think that they looked at what were the leading causes of readmissions, and one of them being heart failure. Right. Is a well-known risk for readmission. It has to do with just the disease process as well, but I think it's a great example of where patients need assistance in managing their chronic condition. Heart failure is a chronic condition that needs to be managed over long term. It can't be just the patient leaves the hospital and we're done and we wait for the next readmission. It has to be a continuum of care along that care path. And there are things that can be done outside of the hospital to prevent the patient from readmitting unnecessarily or decreasing the number of times they readmit. So that was one condition that they focused on, and there's been a lot of progress made with that. But slowly we've expanded beyond really CHF or even the others and really looking at all patients and trying to prevent unnecessary readmissions.
Right. And so it started with CHF, AMI, pneumonia. Those mm-hmm. were the first three. And obviously that lends itself a lot of times to an aging population anyway. And then it expanded and they started looking at lower extremity, the joint replacements, mm-hmm. And then some other groups as they were starting to roll those things in. But like you said, that kind of kicked off, more advancements into the bundled payment idea and kind of where we're getting to now. But you said that you got into the work around the 30-day readmission. If I remember correctly, in your previous role, you built a transitions program for the 30-day readmission. So what were you tasked with there? What was that?
Absolutely. So the Gordon and Betty Moore Foundation provided approximately 20 to 23 hospitals in the Bay Area with grants to build transitions of care programs to reduce not only 30-day but 90-day readmissions as well. And so I was brought on by one of the hospitals to, they had started some work, but really build a transitions of care program to do exactly that, reduce the readmissions. And the goal really was to reduce 30-day readmissions by 30%. And there's multiple things that lead to readmissions. And so there were multiple things that had to be implemented to decrease those readmissions. When we look at where patients are coming from, we know that a huge number of people, when they get discharged from the hospital to a skilled nursing facility, they're at risk for coming back, sometimes at a higher rate than when they go home. And there's several reasons for that. One is that generally speaking, when patients go to skilled nursing after an acute stay, they are sicker than the ones that are going home.
Sure.
Also, skilled nursing facilities, there's definitely risks for picking up other conditions just because of right. the nature. Just like in hospitals, you're exposed to more things, more germs. There's risk for infection. Also, depending on the facility, there may be more stays in bed versus getting out of bed and being more active. Because the population is aging and the people that go to skilled nursing often are in their 80s and 90s, there's more risk for delirium because they're out of their element. They don't know the environment. They've already been in the hospital, which is a different environment. Now another new environment. So they're at risk for more complications and therefore coming back to the hospital. So one of the tasks that I took on was looking at the hospital to skilled nursing and working with the skilled nursing to decrease their readmissions. And then there were other initiatives for tackling the patients that are going directly home from the hospital. And so there were multiple initiatives, multiple projects that we ran side by side to really decrease readmissions from all levels of post-discharge.
Sure. Plus, I mean, there have been studies done, but if you just ask almost anyone in healthcare or out of healthcare, it seems that people recover better at home, if at all possible. And so I know that that's kind of having an impact on where discharge transitions and just care transitions is going in general. But it does seem that has been recognized.
Absolutely. And I think there's a lot of myths around, well, patient, they've been in the hospital, they're deconditioned, so that's a good excuse to send them to skilled nursing. And there are patients that that's appropriate for. There are a lot of patients that going home is best, that recovering in the home and supporting them in the home, whether it be with home health or with caregiving or family, they will actually do better. There is a myth that patients that are at home after hospitalization are at higher risk for readmitting, and that's not necessarily true.
Right. And so on that point, without, you know, diving, you know, or getting too far away from the bundles, which is why we're here today, but, you know, it kind of seemed, especially when the readmission talk was starting at first, that there were four kind of main drivers, around four main drivers of readmissions back to the hospital. It was medication adherence, primary care, lack of a support system, and then not following a care plan, you know, following an inpatient stay. Did you notice some of those things as a main problem when you were working on the 30-day transition problem? Did you see them fall into some of those?
Absolutely. I agree that those are sort of the four main categories. And again, medication reconciliation, we know that that's been a problem for a long time, and there's multiple reasons for that. One is that patients use multiple pharmacies, so it's often hard to get an accurate list. And even when the hospital thinks they have a complete list because they got it from the doctor's office, doesn't mean that that's accurate. The doctor may have a list, but that doesn't mean that's what the patient is taking. So that's one category. The lack of follow-up, absolutely. For years, there's been this, well, follow-up with your doctor in 2 to 3 weeks, except for we know that there are a group of patients that need follow-up in even less than 7 days,
right,
maybe within 48 hours. And that's sort of a new thing for doctor's offices. There are patients that call the doctor afterwards, but they neglect to say, oh, I just spent 2 weeks in the hospital, that I should see you soon. They just make an appointment. And then there's some other things. I think one thing that we haven't talked a lot about is sort of the end of life goals of care, palliative care. There's definitely still some difficulty in having those conversations, and there's some push to have them in the hospital, but that's really late in the disease process. The goals of care, the end of life planning, there's a lot of opportunity to do that earlier in when you're still healthy.
Right.
And there's some people that are moving towards that. There's physicians that are moving towards that. And then there's others that that haven't quite jumped on that bandwagon yet.
Right. And just a little plug for the podcast, and I'm going to totally butcher this because it's off the top of my head, but we actually spoke with the CEO of the Coalition for Compassionate Care of California for a podcast. And so if you're interested in the difference between palliative and hospice, I would recommend checking that out. She was really insightful. And that's something that I hope that people get a better understanding of soon, because for so many people, the word hospice or, you know, the context of that care denotes something that's not the reality of the situation really at all. So feel free to check that out if you have a few more questions about that. So with the program that you ran there, was it successful? What kind of things did you learn that you were able to then take from that experience and bring into the role that you have now?
Yes, absolutely. It was successful. We were able to decrease our readmissions. But I think beyond the actual statistics, there were a lot of lessons learned and changes in workflows and processes for the hospital. So a couple great examples is that when patients were transferred from the hospital to skilled nursing, there was no standard checklist. Some paperwork went for some patients, other paperwork for other patients. The skilled nursing facilities didn't know what they were getting. They were missing certain paperwork. So we were able to standardize. We created a checklist that actually got redone several times. There were multiple versions based on what we were learning. And the skilled nursing facilities absolutely loved it. They shared it with other hospitals because it standardized what they got. They knew exactly what they got. we were also able to, one of the feedbacks was that when they did have to send a patient back to the hospital, when the emergency room got the paperwork, it was all over the place. They couldn't get a clear understanding of what was going on with the patient, who were they contacting or not contacting as far as family, what was the patient's code status. So we were able to implement a skilled nursing to ER checklist, which everybody used, and of course the ER staff absolutely loved. And I think one of the best things that we came up was, because part of our work with skilled nursing was evaluating every 7-day readmission, we had a great lesson learned from a readmission where the hospital was not aware that skilled nursing facilities are not able to give antipsychotic medication without a specific consent from the physician, unlike hospitals. And there was a readmission within 24 hours of a patient who didn't get the medication that they needed. It took some work, it took several months, but we were able to implement a consent form for antipsychotic medication that was completed by the physician in the hospital and was good for 72 hours in the skilled nursing facility. And of course, the facilities implemented it and absolutely adored it. And we were able to cut down on those readmissions. It was a huge change. And shortly after we implemented it, the state health department actually started saying that that's something that that other hospitals should be doing.
Wow, that's a major major success.
Yes.
With that. So obviously, you have since moved on from the hospital that you worked at on the transitions program. What is your new role?
So my new role has to do with the Bundle Payment Care Initiative, BPCI, or also known as BPC, which was a very easy transition for me. I learned so much about readmissions and really the transitions of care and managing patients beyond the walls of the hospital. And so bundles is exactly that. It's the entire episode of care, looking at patients really not just in the hospital but for the 90 days post-discharge. And so building a transitions program and going into bundles was a very easy transition for me.
Yeah, I would imagine. And a lot of people sometimes don't understand the correlation between how readmission really played into bundles. But I think that from the numbers I've seen, readmission within an episode of care can increase the cost of that episode, sometimes double, if not more, just by a readmission and the bed days that are required in the hospital from there. So it really was kind of a natural progression. One thing that I'm sure you get with your position quite often, and it's something, to be honest, I've struggled to be able to vocalize to people. How do you explain bundled payments to an uninitiated, you know, person off of the street who might ask you about your position? How do you explain that in kind of layman's terms?
That's a great question. It's not an easy thing to do because it is very encompassing and there's a lot that goes into bundle payment. And even other people in healthcare have a hard time understanding what exactly it means. I think the easiest way to put it is that the hospital is taking on the responsibility to make sure that when you leave the hospital, when a person leaves the hospital, that you are not on your own, that you have the support of staff at the hospital and in the community that who are making sure that you're getting the follow-up you need, that you're getting the medication that you need, that if you have any questions, that those are being addressed, and that trying to really prevent you from having to come back to the hospital. And while, of course, financial reasons are a big part of it, that's not the most important. I think it's important to recognize that when an elderly, when a fragile person comes into the hospital, they often come out a little bit weaker than they were when they came in. And the more times they come back to the hospital, the weaker they get.
Right. I think that I know for a lot of people that work in the hospital, that's a frustrating misconception that people have about their hospital stay. More than likely, you're not going to leave the hospital recovered, fully recovered. You are going to still have quite a long road, depending on what your what your inpatient stay is for. But I think a lot of people assume that they're coming to the hospital and they're going to leave at 100%. And so with the following afterwards, I do actually think that for all of the frustrations and issues that it's caused, that it really is moving towards a more patient-centered care. Do you kind of feel that shift happening, or that there really is more of a focus on patient outcome?
Absolutely. I think that's the whole idea of moving away from fee-for-service and really moving towards value and quality care. And so, yes, patient-centered, putting the patient in the middle and encircling them with all the providers, the case management, the pharmacy needs, the home health needs, the caregiving, the family in there as well, making them the center. And the hospitalization is just one part of an entire episode, or it should not be the main focus.
Right. So in kind of a broader sense, when CMS started moving towards bundles, both the voluntary and the mandatory bundles, what do you think they were trying to achieve in kind of a bigger picture?
I think that, there's the financial picture, is that we have been spending Medicare dollars for a long time, and with baby boomers, and not to blame an entire generation for increase in cost, but with the baby boomers, we just can't keep going at the rate that we've been going,
right,
without really paying attention to the outcomes. And so I think Medicare is moving towards not just responsible spending, but also making sure that what we do counts in a qualitative manner. And so I think we're in this sort of a rush. Why Medicare is cranking up how fast we're going into mandatory bundles is because they are feeling the pressure with baby boomers, with so many people turning 65 every day, that we just can't keep going at the rate that we've been going at. And I recently heard a physician actually said this to a family member when they demanded that the patient, that their mother get a higher level of care. And the physician equated it to global warming, that we all have to play a role. We all have a responsibility that if we don't do our share in savings and making sure that we're spending money responsibly, then it's just not going to exist. Medicare will not exist in the future.
And I think that part of that plays into the fact that, again, people who might not know have a kind of, for lack of a better term, romanticized version of what their healthcare process is going to look like, especially after a hospitalization. And so with the global warming example, it's not that you personally have to give something up. It's just that actually you don't really need that higher level of care, and it's kind of paring it down to what exactly you need. So with your health system, and it's a larger health system, what did this change mean? I know you talked about, when you explain bundles to people, that it's not just the hospitalization anymore. So what did it mean for your health system as far as engaging post-acute, changes, inpatient, those kinds of things?
Yeah. So I think it's important just to clarify that bundle payment means that the hospital is taking on a financial risk. Everyone is still billing Medicare the same exact way, whether it be the hospital, doctor's offices, skilled nursing, home health, etc. However, at the end of episodes of care, Medicare is adding up all those bills.
Right.
And the hospital has said that we're going to take on the risk. If the bills add up to the target price that Medicare has set, then that's great. However, if all the bills from all the post-acute and the acute stay add up to a higher than what Medicare has deemed necessary, then the hospital will have to be financially responsible for that and pay for it, pay a check to Medicare. And so the hospital has taken on a lot of risk with
right.
this. So what does that mean? Where are the opportunities for savings? Most of the opportunities are really not in the acute stay.
Right.
Hospitals are reimbursed on a DRG basis, so that's for the most part a fixed cost. So when we look at savings, it's in the post-acute period.
Sure.
And there's sort of a few categories that are important to tackle. One is looking at what level of care the patients are going to after discharge. If patients are going to acute rehab or a long-term acute care hospital, LTAC, those are expensive stays. However, if that's the most appropriate for the patient, then that's where they should go. If a patient is going to skilled nursing, then we have to make sure that that's appropriate for the patient. The patient really needs to go to skilled nursing, that they will not be safe in the home setting. And if you can determine that they can go home with the right resources, and skilled nursing is more of a preference for the patient or a comfort, then it's up to the hospital to work with the patient, along with the physician and everyone else, to make sure that the patient is aware that skilled nursing may not be the best, not just because of financial reasons, but because they may benefit from home in a long term better from the right. from home than right. from skilled nursing, that there's more risk in going to skilled nursing. Home health is a great service that Medicare patients can benefit from. So if you can send a patient home and you think that home health is something that will make sure that they can stay in the home safely and not readmit, then that's another resource for them. So really looking at, so I would say bucket number one is looking at the level of care they go to from the hospital and making sure that it's the least restrictive, most appropriate level of care for that patient. We're not trying to take away a service. We're just making sure that it's the right level that they're getting. The next bucket that I like to look at, and really everybody in bundle payment is looking at, is the skilled nursing length of stay. Right. And this is one of those things that's a little bit less popular. Unlike acute rehab or long-term acute care hospitals, which also get reimbursed by the DRG, mostly a fixed reimbursement, skilled nursing facilities get paid by the day. And so there is this sort of thought that the longer the stay from a business model, the better it is for a skilled nursing facility, kind of like a hotel. They get paid by the day. Also, many Medicare patients are wise and know that they have a benefit that will allow them to stay 20 days.
Right.
And so whether it's the patient or the family, it's nice for them that they're elderly family member can stay there for 20 days while perhaps they go on vacation, or just gives them enough time to maybe hire a caregiver. So patients often have an expectation that they'll stay 20 days.
Right.
There's a trend now to decrease that. It's not about how many days Medicare is willing to pay, but what's really appropriate for the patient. If they are ready to go home at 12 days, then they should go home at 12 days. If they need the full 20 days, then absolutely. But we want to make sure that the patients aren't staying longer than absolutely necessary. And I think many skilled nursing facilities are recognizing this change, and they're willing to work with the hospitals to decrease the length of stay in the skilled nursing. The home health agencies are also recognizing this change, and therefore what I'd like to say is they're upping their game when it comes to the services they provide and the frequency that they provide, so that when they do get patients that are leaving the skilled nursing facility a little bit earlier than in the past, that they still get a very robust program in the home, and they make that transition very smooth. Most people that leave the skilled nursing facility get some sort of home health, and the home healths are really stepping up to meet the needs.
Right. And I think that a big part of that is because they don't have much of a choice, especially I know we both have been acquainted with Josh Luke and heard Josh talk before. And he talks a lot about how hospitals are basically becoming the insurance systems themselves. One thing you did touch on. So right now, the way that you're paid with bundles, it's in a retrospective model. And I understand how that can be very difficult, especially when you're trying to be innovative, because you're still billing for things the way that you had during fee for service, but then you're graded against kind of the average after. I was talking with someone the other day who said that there would maybe be more changes with a prospective payment model for some of these things. Just really quickly, we don't have to dive into it, but what would be kind of the difference if you had more leeway? Say, here's a capitated amount of money for a patient, or if you were paid prospectively, what other kinds of things could you explore that you might not be able to now?
Absolutely. Right now, when it comes to working with skilled nursing, it's really more of an advisory level that we can ask, we can work with them, but we can't mandate that they discharge a patient within 12 days because we feel that the patient is ready. Right. It's very much, please work with us, please help us meet this deadline. But we can't come in and dictate, which is very different from HMOs. And I tend to lean a lot on the Kaiser model, that they manage their patients. They are an insurance company, and right. So they get to tell the skilled nursing facilities exactly how long a patient has in the skilled nursing facility. Same with other HMOs. If a patient in the hospital needs a skilled nursing, they have to get pre-authorization before they ever refer a patient there. And then that insurance company dictates to the skilled nursing facility how long that patient has. They have to reauthorize for 7 days, and then every 7 days they keep reauthorizing. Right. And right now, the bundle payment patients aren't there yet. I think that's where it's going,
right.
But we're not there yet. Once it's there, there's no question that the hospital will act like an insurance company.
Right. And for anybody, and this is not a knock on home health or skilled nursing, but for anybody who's ever worked alongside those places, that do great work. But Medicare is also always the patients that they want the most, partly because of the no need for a pre-authorization, or at least as the way it has been, and also the higher reimbursement. And just so that people understand, with not being able to dictate the number of days, every subsequent day that someone stays at a skilled nursing facility is just pushing the cost of that episode up. And so then when you're being graded against other systems who maybe have gotten their length of stay in SNF down, that obviously can hurt you directly there. This has been a great talk, and we're already pushing. I don't want to keep you for much longer. But one thing I did want to touch on, because I think that you kind of are dealing in both worlds. So with the BPCI, with the BPCI, that was really a voluntary involvement in bundled payments. And you had mentioned DRGs a little bit, diagnosis-related groups. First of all, what would like an example of a DRG be?
So one of the voluntary DRGs that we're participating is pneumonia.
Okay, great. So just so people know, there were four models in the BPCI program, and I would imagine as a hospital system, are you in the model two?
Yeah, okay. Like most hospitals, we're in model two.
Yeah, and then if you were a skilled nursing facility initiating a bundle, you were in three. But there have also been some changes, and CJR came about. And CJR was kind of a quick step then into mandatory bundles. So can you give us a brief idea of CJR?
Absolutely. CJR stands for Comprehensive Care for Joint Replacement. And this was an initiative that rolled out very quickly. The announcement was made in July 2015. Initially, it was slated to start in 75 markets, or what they call MSAs, market service areas, metropolitan service areas, yeah. January 1st. So they basically gave, CMS gave 6 months, but after some response from the healthcare community, it was decreased to 67 MSAs and started April 1st. I was in an interesting area where, because I'm in the San Francisco market, I had two hospitals that were doing bundle payment, but a third hospital in this area, outside of the city of San Francisco, was not in bundle payment, but was one of the was part of an MSA that was required to start CJR. Again, BPCI being a voluntary program, CJR became mandatory April 1st, 2016. And so I now have to manage the BPCI program, but also the CJR right. program. The San Francisco hospitals would also be part of CJR if they weren't already right. in BPCI.
Which was the only way you could be excluded from
exactly.
it. Exactly.
Right? Interesting, someone asked me in a different market, how do we opt into CJR? You can't.
Right.
It is Medicare designated specific MSAs, and no one can opt in, no one can opt out. It's the target pricing is very different also from BPCI, and I won't get into too much details. There's a lot of information online about it. But I think the idea that Medicare really is focused on is that spending across the country on the same exact diagnosis or procedure is really all over the place. You could have a total hip surgery, total hip replacement in Boston and pay one thing, and in Alaska pay a completely different price.
Right.
And the idea is that Medicare really wants the same procedure to cost about the same amount, right, be billed about the same amount, and that's where CJR is going. And they are very quickly increasing the number of episodes or number of diagnoses that are going to become mandatory. We think that pretty soon hip fractures will become mandatory, where it's just a pinning, what's known as an ORIF, open reduction. Internal fixation will become mandatory most likely next year. Also, there's a lot of talk that cardiac bundles,
right,
will be mandatory next year.
Right. So right now it's the lower extremity joint replacements, so hips and knees. They're also adding femurs, I believe, coming up. And then there was the talk or the announcement about the cardiac bundle of stents and...
So PCI, percutaneous catheter... intervention, PCI, stenting, AMI, acute myocardial infarction, AMI with PCI, and then, of course, CABG, which is your bypass surgeries.
Right.
I think that this is just the beginning. I think we're going to see this just continue to grow and grow, and I think fee-for-service is just going to be something that in 10 years we'll be talking about in a history class.
Right. Yeah, it does. It certainly does seem that way. So kind of to wrap up here, really briefly, and obviously, you know, in my other life, I work in non-medical home care, which is not a Medicare beneficiary. But it's not yet. Yeah, I agree. But part of that, actually, and part of the not yet part, is it seems like they're starting to allow for some flexibility in working with other partners. Have you seen that? Have you noticed? And not just home care, not just the non-medical home care, but also, you know, boarding care or assisted living, those kinds of things that typically aren't reimbursed by Medicare. Are you seeing it kind of moving that way also?
Yeah, I think that's the idea that Medicare, I think they're definitely looking at it, but I think one of the things with these initiatives, it's really up to the hospital to think out of the box and come up with creative ways to save money. And so home care, definitely non-skilled private caregiving, is something that many hospitals are looking at and even doing, as far as actually paying for that service for families who can't afford to pay for it, because paying for a few hours a day of private caregiving is quite a bit less than sending a patient to skilled nursing.
Right.
Another sort of out-of-the-box area focus, and I know that a lot of people are doing, is hospitals paying for a couple weeks at an assisted living,
right,
instead of skilled nursing or board and care, providing that service. You're right. Medicare isn't quite there yet in paying for that, but I think that we're going to see a lot of changes depending on the outcome of the presidential election. But I think that we will see changes where Medicare will sort of jump on that bandwagon and say, okay, if we pay for 2 weeks of private caregiving, we're going to save money on skilled nursing. And again, not to, you know, badmouth skilled nursing. There's definitely a need for that. But I think we're going to see healthier patients stay out of skilled nursing, and really the really, really sick patients going to skilled nursing as an extension of the acute stay in the hospital.
Well, I think that the lower extremity replacements is a good example of that, where not only has the hospital length of stay for those procedures gone way down, but in some cases people aren't going to skilled nursing at all, and just utilization of home health and even the private duty to help with some of those things in the home. Last thing, just before I let you go, and this has been really insightful. Thank you so much for sitting down. But just the last thing before I go, where do you think CMS takes, where do you think that it goes from here as far as bundles? Do you think that there are going to be more mandatories, maybe more metropolitan areas that are included? Is it just going to move towards this in general? And also, do you see private insurances following suit?
That's a very good point. I don't work for CMS, and I can't speak for them.
Right.
But from everything I have seen, I think that this isn't going anywhere, and I think it's going to just continue to grow. I think the diagnoses that are going to be mandatory, that list is going to continue to grow. I also think that the MSAs are going to just be added on, where I think eventually fee-for-service will be more the rare thing, and everybody will be managed care, every age population, you know, whether it's, I think everybody will be managed care. I think fee-for-service, Medicare will virtually cease to exist.
Right.
And as far as private insurance, absolutely. I think that the HMOs, the big insurance companies are going to jump into this. Looking at readmissions, for instance, if Medicare is not going to pay for a readmission, private insurance is going to say, why should we?
Right.
And the savings opportunities, for instance, taking total joints, there is this huge push for Medicare patients to go home after a hip or a knee replacement. Private insurance is going to do the same thing. And they're going to be looking at hospitals, and they're going to say, if I send this patient to hospital A and that hospital spends $50,000 on a total joint because they're sending them to skilled nursing, but a hospital B down the street only costs me $20,000 for the same exact episode of care because they're sending the patient home and the patient's do fine.
Right.
We're going to work with that hospital that saves us money.
Right.
And I think Medicare is going to be used the same way, and private insurance as well.
And I do encourage people to look up. It's not hard to find if you Google kind of the range, especially of lower joints, just so people know with the reason it's mandatory. I believe that was the most common surgery done through CMS. Somewhere in the neighborhood of like $7 billion in 2014 spent on those surgeries. And I would encourage you to look at the range, because it really is like on the low end around $20,000 an episode, and ranging up towards even six figures sometimes for some of those episodes. And it really is some striking numbers. Well, hey, Ruth, thank you so much for sitting down with me. It really was a pleasure, and it was really insightful. And I encourage people to look these things up, or you can always reach out to me as well to answer any of these questions. Thanks so much for sitting down with me.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. As always, thank you for listening to Pop Health Podcast. You can find me on Twitter at Pop Health Zach. I encourage you to look us up on our website, pophealthpodcast.com, or in the App Store, anywhere you can find podcasts on iTunes. Thanks a lot, and have a great day.